supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, when I was young, cancer was stigmatized. It was called the Big C, or I remember people whispering, "She's got cancer." Nobody talked about it. Well, over the decades, scientific information helped eliminate that. Not so with mental illness. In the last few decades, we've learned about the genetics and the neurobiology of mental illness. We've learned effective therapies and medications. Still, it's treated differently by insurance companies, healthcare facilities, employers, and even family members. Why is this happening, and what can we do about it? My guest today, our Dr. Fred Markowitz. He's from Northern Illinois University. He studied mental illness and stigma extensively. Later, we'll hear from Elena Mabasso, a writer who is open about her experience with a mood disorder. First, Fred Markowitz. Fred, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Dan.
I'm going to give out the phone number so people can call. Our number is 888-477-9499. We're talking about stigma around mental illness. Again, that's 888-477-9499. So tell me, Fred, why is stigma so persistent?
It is, on one hand, Americans' understanding of mental illness has increased quite a bit. People become very sophisticated at understanding different kinds of mental illnesses. They understand its biogenetic causes. But on the other hand, the stereotype of dangerousness associated with mental illness is very persistent. And unfortunately, unlike a lot of other illnesses, the very definition of mental illness involves some impairment in social functioning that makes people often perceive those with mental illness as somehow being responsible for causing their own behavioral problems.
Well, one of the things I worry about with stigma is when we read about these incidences of violence. And you know, of course, the recent one with the Lusitania Airlines, a co-pilot who was suicidal and depressed, and we hear this over and over, and you know, who's doing these things, and it's people with a history of mental illness. So, I mean, you almost can't help but to associate the two, even though they are a small minority of people with mental illness, but that's not what we hear about every day in the news.
I think that's true. On one hand, people with some mental illnesses can be at an increased risk of violence, but that is a very small proportion of all the people that have a mental illness. However, when you hear about these widely publicized incidents involving somebody with mental illness, I think it tends to color people's perception that, in other words, they may overestimate the degree to which people with mental illness are at a risk of violent behavior.
Yeah, I want to talk about how do we fix that? How do we change that perception? We can explain why the perception's there. We can understand that. We can say over and over and over again that that's just a small minority, but that doesn't change anything, really.
It is very difficult, I think, to change public perceptions. In fact, some well-known nationally representative studies show that over the last couple of decades or so, the stereotype of dangerousness associated with mental illness really does persist despite the increase in sophistication of people's understanding of the causes of mental illness. And so it does make it very hard to overcome, I think, once people form their opinions, not only with regard to dangerousness and mental illness, but on a wide variety of social issues and problems, that those attitudes become very hard to overcome. They become rather fixed. And so I think the prevailing strategy is that people with mental illness, they may need to promote the idea that despite having a mental illness, that they are not violent, that they've managed to lead successful, productive lives, despite the challenges of mental illness. And so the thinking on the part of a lot of folks, both the mental health consumers and researchers, is that we need to promote those kind of success stories to counter the stories that we hear about some dangerous events.
And we hear it happening. You know, well-known people are kind of taking ownership of their depression and bipolar disorder. And I've talked here on the air about my history of severe depressive episodes. I've had two, if not three, already. And I mean, I'm certainly not violent. My most violent tendency is this guilt I put on myself. So, you know, we need that more and more, understandably. But the history of discrimination with mental illness goes way back before any media that we know of, besides word of mouth, of course. We have always either been afraid of them, institutionalized them, put them to, you know, had them killed.
That's right. A long history of segregating people with mental illness, whether it be an institution or having people with mental illness reside in group homes in less desirable neighborhoods in the community, so that there's a sense of othering. People with mental illness are those people, not me. And when, in fact, people with mental illness, especially very common illnesses like depression and anxiety, people would be surprised to know just how prevalent those kinds of illnesses really are, and that people with mental illness are not necessarily the kind of scary other that that people often conclude.
Yeah, we really need to understand what we're talking about. We keep using those two words, mental illness. You know, I was asked at a lecture if I knew of a daycare center for people with disabilities, and I said, not that I could think of. But then I thought about it, and I thought, well, who would go? You know, it would be people in wheelchairs, certainly blind people, people with walkers, and you know, on and on. But what about people with mental illness? Well, sure, they would be admitted to the daycare center. And then what about people with depression or anxiety? Or, you know, you open a daycare center like that, then whose mind in the store? Everybody's in the daycare center. So I don't know what the hell we're talking about, you know?
Right, and it's important to realize that there are, of course, many different varieties of mental illness. And in fact, some people would say that we really need to refer to mental illnesses, and that not everybody with a diagnosis of one of those mental illnesses, that people are not the same. There's a wide range from severely debilitating disorders like schizophrenia. There's bipolar disorder. There's depression, anxiety, which are more common. There are substance abuse disorders, so that it does require people to think about really the wide range of disorders, the differences in how those illnesses impact people's lives, and the differences to which people with various disorders are at somewhat of an increased risk of violent behavior, and the degree to which they are capable of recovery. So it really requires a degree of complexity in our thinking that we are often not prepared for, that we like very simple kind of answers and straightforward black and white ways of thinking.
We've done that quite well with autism and autism spectrum disorders. I want to switch gears here a little bit, Fred, and that is we're going. Patrick Kennedy is probably best known for writing the Mental Health Parity Act when he was in Congress, and thankfully that act was passed. So what is it? Is it really working?
Well, I think it might be a little too early to tell.
Yeah, We all had hoped that there would be real parity in this. I got another question. That there's been this big push. You know, I talked about in my introduction about what we've learned about genetics and neurobiology, and how down at the National Institute of Health, the 90s was the decade of the brain. So there's been this big press to call mental illness a brain disorder. Do you think that is a simple truth? Is it helping stigma? Is it harming?
Well, there was, of course, a lot of hope pinned on the idea that to the extent to which we more fully understood mental illness as being caused in large part by biogenetics, and as people gained a greater understanding of that, that that would help destigmatize mental illness. In other words, seeing it as a no-fault disease like many other health conditions that are caused by genetic predispositions. Unfortunately, the research does not support that. In fact, the research finds that when people do think about mental illness in terms of having biogenetic underpinnings, that it doesn't make them necessarily more sympathetic or understanding. It makes them perhaps more likely to see a person with a mental illness as somehow fundamentally flawed, and therefore somebody you would not, for example, want to date or marry or reproduce with.
Oy vey. But I got to tell you, and I just want to make this comment, and I want to get a call in before we have to take our break. I find it very helpful as a clinician in my office when someone has a mental illness or they're there with their family. You know, I can talk about the genetics and the biology, and the bottom line is, you know, I'm able to say to them, it's not your fault. It's not something you did. It's not a weakness. You're not lazy. It's not your fault. And boy, you know, I watch shoulders drop, and I listen to sighs when I'm able to say that. So, you know, in the individual level, it's helpful. And on the larger level, I get you, it's really not. Let's see if we can get a call in. We've got Christina on the line. Hey, Christina. Hello?
Hi.
Hi,
I'm Christina Mueller. I'm the founder of the Reuptake Project, which is a theater project that is out to end the stigma of depression and mental illness.
What do you do?
We've performed once, and we're performing at a teen wellness fair in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And we are a group of people who we have made a devised theater piece about our own experiences with depression. But what was really important to me was that some of us have suffered from depression or are suffering from severe depression, and some of us have not. Because where the impetus to make the Reuptake Project came from is that one of my very best friends was diagnosed with depression in her early 20s, and I, on reflecting upon it, recognized that I had no idea how to really deal with it or approach her, and I felt like I kind of ended up, you know, giving up on her and not really having a relationship with her.
Christina, tell us what the performance looks like.
Well, each of us, we have eight people in the group, and each of us has like come up with a vignette about their own experience with depression, whether that's their own depression or an experience with the depression of a loved one. And then we all perform in each vignette, and it's a lot of movement-based theater. We had some video projections and self-written poems and things like that.
And you're based in New York, yes?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And when are you coming to Cherry Hill?
We're coming on May 17th.
All right. We'll try to get that up on our website and get all relevant information. Christina, thanks so much. Thanks so much for your call, and thank you for the work you do.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
We've got to take a short break. We've been talking about mental illness and stigma, why it's here, what it does to individuals, and including the larger culture, and what we can do about it. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. We've been talking with Fred Markowitz. He's associate professor at Northern Illinois University. And after our break, we'll be joined by writer Elena Mabasso to talk about her life, her experience, and her writing around mental illness. Again, our phone number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Devereaux, one of the leaders in behavioral health care, helps to provide care for children and adolescents with mental health challenges, as well as individuals of all ages living with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Across its national network, Devereaux helps provide meaningful care to individuals and families where they need it most. Whether it be through community and educational programs, employment services, foster care assistance, or individual or group living support. Learn more at devereaux.org.
Do you remember your first time?
My first time? First time of what?
My first time ever?
It's a little uncomfortable. Should I talk about it now?
Your first time listening to NPR's Morning Edition, that is.
People just talking like normal people, telling me about the world.
There's always one story that makes me wake up.
No matter how many times you've listened, listen again each weekday to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us for NPR's Morning Edition, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family with Dr. Fred Markowitz and, as promised, Elena Mabasso. Elena, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right, so you've been listening to a lot on that first segment, a lot of information passed by you before we went on the air. You said you were, what, 95% writer?
That's right.
And 5% talker. And throughout that first segment, you have been writing and writing and writing. Can I ask you to summarize your thoughts on what you were hearing? What came out that was important or moved you?
Sure. There's a lot of things that I think are important there. One thing that particularly struck me was that idea of categorizing mental illness with just that one term, mental illness, and how we need to have so much more nuance in how we view this. Like you were saying, or like Fred was saying, mental illnesses, at least, that would be a starting point to understand that where else in the medical field are we going to try to categorize something as diverse as, you know, like you were saying, schizophrenia or bipolar disorder with depression and anxiety and many other issues? They all get grouped together under one category. How is that helping any of us?
So let's, you and I, if you don't mind, I want to have a conversation with you about your life, your quote-unquote mental illness. And first, do you consider yourself having a mental illness?
I'm glad that you brought this up. This was something that I wanted to ask you as well. This question goes back and forth, and different practitioners have different opinions about it. If you have major depressive episodes, which I have had repeatedly for as long as I can remember, does that mean you are mentally ill? I would say that there certainly are times in my own life when my depression incapacitates me as much as any other physical illness that you might expect. And there are other times when it's more low grade, more in the background, and I'm very, very productive. So again, going back to that idea of nuance in these terms, I might say yes some days, but I might say no on
other
days.
You said something that got me angry. You said the question, am I mentally ill? Mm. And here's what got me angry.
Tell me.
Damn it, you are not mentally ill. There's a big difference between having a mental illness. I am not a depressive.
Mm.
You know, a friend is not a schizophrenic.
Absolutely.
You are a person.
That's absolutely
you
right.
You know, so that's why I asked the question. Mm. And P.S., you haven't answered it yet. Do you consider yourself having a mental illness?
I would say that, yes, I could take that on, and I would consider myself a person who does have a mental illness. And I could say that just like anyone else might be able to say that for a range of physical illnesses.
So, here's where I want to have the conversation with you. Because as a mental health professional, my instinct wants to know your label. Depression, bipolar disorder. I want to know your label. And I know at the deeper sense, it's not relevant. So I guess the respectful question I would ask you, where does it hurt? Where do you suffer? How do you suffer? Are you suffering right now?
I think that it's always with me to a certain degree. And it affects you on a lot of levels.
What's the it?
These, what do you want to call it? Mood disorder, mental illness, depression, okay. How that interacts with, you know, various, you know, physical issues that I have going on. And I think that this question of labeling that you land on is so interesting. And also, like you say, also possibly not even important in the big scheme of things. And that idea about labeling is something that affects me a lot because I've been through many experiences in that way, you know, on that couch across from a practitioner, say a psychotherapist or a psychiatrist, and telling me I have adjustment disorder, I have major depression. Earlier in the segment, you mentioned my writing throughout the earlier segment. This is how I think and process and stay grounded and, you know, put things into my mind that I might want to come back to later. I did this in a session with a psychiatrist once. I take notes all the time. It's kind of my syndrome as a writer. He said I had obsessive compulsive personality disorder.
There you go.
Because I write too much.
There you go.
He knows I'm a professional writer. So you want to get into the pain that some of the labels of mental illness can cause.
I want to know.
There you go.
Yeah, know what? As a clinician, as a fellow human, I want to know who you are. I want to know what it's like to be you. Because I'm not so sure these labels. You know, it's the grand delusion that obsessive compulsive personality, then we've got X treatment for you or these. Crap. It really is.
I'm still going to go and write the next story, yeah. You know, whatever it is he says.
Let's get a caller on. We've got, and sorry but to put you on a back burner, Fred. I know you're there. Let's get Adam on the line.
Hello.
Hi, Adam.
Hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. The reason I'm calling is because many years ago, about 8 years ago, I was romantically involved with somebody. I was engaged to somebody who I knew had depression and was on medication for depression, and I didn't want to stigmatize her, and I didn't want to judge her for something that, as you said earlier in the show, was not her fault. At the same time, without walking you through the complete soap opera, she aborted my child. She committed suicide. Her father, who was also mentally ill, came after my family. Hateful things, which were completely not true, have been said about me and my family. I received calls at work from her friends who didn't really know what had happened, calling me a murderer. And it's going on 8 years later, and I have panic attacks all the time. I have not had a decent night's sleep in all that time. My question, and I'll take this off the air, is at what point is it wrong not to I don't want to say stigmatized, but to operate in your own self-interest and to say, I must be careful or I should not get involved with this person because who knows what the fallout could be. There was a lot of damage that came out of this relationship.
Wait a minute, Adam. I'm confused. What is your call really about? What do you want from these experts?
Well, what I'd like to know is, at what point do we draw the line between saying we're stigmatizing and saying we must proceed with caution with somebody who we know is dealing with a very difficult problem that is maybe out of their hands? This is an academic question. This is not anything beyond that at this point for me.
Yeah, you can employ the CYA strategy without be stigmatizing. You know, you can, my God, you have to protect yourself. You have to look out for your own best interest. And if you're saying that your friend who committed suicide did so because of her illness, that's not stigmatizing. If you say that all people with mental illness put people at risk, that's stigmatizing. Fred, how would you weigh in on this?
Well, Adam's example, quite the extreme situation, but it does highlight the dilemma that people find themselves in terms of knowing that somebody has a mental illness, and to what extent do they realize that establishing a relationship with them might present certain challenges and might even result in a harmful relationship. And so I think that the question of where to draw the line, well, researchers have talked about what they call the burden of sympathy. In other words, people have a limit to the depths of their compassion and the depths of their understanding, their willingness to ride out the tough times. And so I think when we're talking about stigma, we're talking about not even giving people the initial chance, which it sounds like from Adam's story, he definitely gave this person the chance, and then, of course, the situation became obviously unmanageable. And so I think that we ought to give people the chance, but it's a very individual choice as to what we think we can handle. Now, of course, when it comes to a family member, sometimes we have no choice.
You've got fewer options there.
That's right.
I wonder if if you could just very quickly weigh in on this, Selena.
Sure. One thing I would say is that this whole conversation about reducing the stigma about depression or mental illnesses or whatever you'd like to call it is not just something that should benefit the people, say, like me, who are suffering, or like your loved one, Adam. I'm so sorry to hear your story. This is something that should benefit everyone who also wants to offer support to people in this situation. I also have been in some heartbreaking situations of my own where I've found that my loved ones can't cope with the space that I'm in emotionally and physically as a result of the fallout of that depression. And I would want everyone facing that to know that you are not and you should not be alone in that work of supporting your loved one who has these problems. This should be something that you should see as a larger network. You also should have your own resources to be able to pull on
excellent.
To support people.
Excellent, excellent point. Before we go to break, I want to share something with all of you. I recently spoke with Lori and Lee Maxwell about their new foundation. It's called DMAX. In memory of their son who suffered with depression. So in order to combat stigma and create community around mental health, their foundation will help create DMAX social clubs on college campuses. I first asked them why the name DMAX.
That was Dan's nickname in sports.
Max.
DMAX.
His
teammates called him DMAX.
Dan committed suicide.
He took his life.
Qualified that. You changed that. Why?
People need to realize that it's important not to say that someone who took their life committed anything, because it sounds like they've committed a crime. So people who have loved ones who have taken their lives generally talk about the person having taken their life or having completed suicide.
When did this happen?
July 21st, 2013.
My God, that was like yesterday.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it feels that way.
It sure does.
To you, Lee, what happened to you that day?
It was traumatic and catastrophic and horrible. It was a reasonable day. There were some things that happened, but it was the evening when we were notified by Dan, by text, that he was just about to take his life.
You had known he was suffering. I guess that's a question. Did you?
We did. We knew that in spades, and we did everything we possibly could. It was like we devoted half or three quarters of our days for months and even a year or so trying to get him better.
Better from what? What was he suffering from or with?
Depression.
Depression.
Right.
Now, we talking heads like to say that depression is treatable, you get the right treatment, yada, 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 with very few exceptions.
Dan had, it was a year and a half he was depressed, and he...
That we know.
He was...
Probably more.
He was constantly looking on the internet, like every single night, trying to figure out how to... A new treatment that would help him. He had therapy. He had several different psychiatrists, and he had numerous different medications, and nothing worked.
Why stigma? Why are you devoting your work, your foundation, to stigma? My God, there's, you know, 100 ways to look at this, to deal with this, to carry this legacy. Why stigma of all things?
It was because we felt it. We as adults, and we found out, well, we really realized that Dan felt it too. And the stigma manifested itself in terms of isolation. We did not feel, Lori and I or Dan, that it was okay to reveal, you know, the depression, the bad feelings, the less than I have a happy face, everything's going fine attitude that, you know, is true in life in general. So we felt that we felt the stigma of being not happy.
Why? Why did you not reveal it? What were you concerned about?
It's not looked at by people as something that is okay to talk about. We actually went to something that NAMI has called Family to Family.
National Alliance of Mental Illness.
Right. And when we walked in there, there were, I guess, 20 people altogether who had mostly a child, but a sibling who had some form of mental illness. And it was amazing to be in there because we felt like we could talk about it for the first time. Yeah. And it wasn't the first time. I mean, there were a few friends that I shared it with. But Dan certainly, he actually shared it with a couple people, but he did not want his teammates to know. He didn't want people in school to know that he was doing, that life was so difficult for him or had become so difficult for him.
You know, it's heartbreaking, and I mean, looking at it from your point of view, especially Dan's point of view, it makes sense. You know, at his age with those kids, At that age.
And Dan had so many friends, and when he got sick, he isolated himself. He couldn't talk to his friends, and he started staying at home all the time.
Well, and that's also a symptom of depression as it gets more severe also.
He had been, just to let you know a little bit about him personally, he was a National Honor Society student member, and he was a three-sport varsity athlete, football, basketball, lacrosse.
But other than that, was he well accomplished?
And well loved.
And well loved,
he has
too.
So many friends that loved him.
You know, I was treating a woman many years ago whose son took his life on the same day that someone in their community's son or daughter, I don't remember, died of an illness. You know, I don't recall what it was. And the outpouring for the boy who died of an illness was, you know, the whole community was out. And, like, nobody showed up at her house.
It's terrible.
It's scary.
It's changed.
You said scary. Tell me about scary, Lee.
I just think, and I'm talking a little bit from my own point of view, when you hear the word depressed or mental illness, it's scary because it's ill-defined. If you say cancer, you kind of know what cancer is. You read about it all the time. People go into hospitals, they often get better. When you talk about depression or mental illness, it's so, I mean, scary is the right word. It's not, it's like, is this person, can I talk to this person? Is this person going to do something wild and weird? How do I talk to them? Can I talk to them like a normal human being?
That was Lee and Lori Maxwell, who lost their son Dan to depression. They started a foundation in their son's memory called the DMAX Foundation. More on that foundation on our webpage and how they're hosting Patrick Kennedy here in at Bryn Mawr College on April 27th. Well, and we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll speak with more with Dr. Markowitz and Elena Mabasso. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Caring Friends Home Care, a nonprofit Quaker-based organization, provides in-home care. Services include home care aides, meal preparation, dressing, hygiene, light housekeeping, and more. With hourly or live-in care, clients receive services while remaining in their own homes. Clients living in long-term care communities can receive additional support. Details at caringfriendshomecare.org.
Proudly supporting WHYY, Camp Hill Special School with day and boarding options is dedicated to redefining what is possible for children and youth with special needs. Students not only contribute to their class communities, but the community as a whole. Taking part in festivals, starring in plays, caring for animals, participating on student council, and fulfilling meaningful roles in their on-campus homes. Offering a campus tour on April 29th at 9 a.m. For more information, CampHillSpecialSchool.org.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about stigma around mental illness with Dr. Fred Markowitz, who's at Northern Illinois University, who's really devoted his career to these issues. We're also joined here in the studio by writer Elena Mabasso. And we're going to go to the phones after we talk with Elena for just a minute. Elena, you listened to that couple and that interview with, the Maxwells. You really had a look of anguish on your face while they were talking.
I would say that sometimes on the inside of this, and this is something I realized too, I think a lot of times when people talk about depression and the tragedies that can grow out of it, we do it stepped back. Maybe it was years ago. Maybe we're feeling better now, and it's okay to talk about. Sometimes we talk about it while we're still in it, and I certainly can't conceal the fact that I absolutely am still in this battle every day. This is not something I'm coming on to tell you, I had a depressive episode once and I can relate. No, this is something that's present in my life every day. So when I do hear about the struggles and the tragedies that other people have gone through with, similar experiences with this illness, I also know people who have taken their lives in my community. It's like their feelings become your own, almost as if you can't separate them. There's just a huge well of feeling there that you never know when you're going to tap in.
What they say in Chinese medicine is they talk about a heart protector, and around these issues, your heart protector is pretty porous as you listen to this.
Yeah, I think that that's a fair way to put it. I saw something interesting describing the idea of depression recently, which is there's this mistaken idea that people who are depressed can't experience happiness or joy or a range of emotions. And the truth is we absolutely can. Maybe it's more transient than with healthy people. But they're also, in general, can be so much, I guess you could say, fewer space we have emotionally to cope with things that might be easier for a healthy person to cope with. So much of us emotionally and physically is taken up with this.
Let me ask you a quick question. You said, before we bring back Fred and go to the callers, you said you struggle with it every day. Do you take medication? Are you in psychotherapy? What have you found effective for you?
Sure. I am in psychotherapy. I have a great therapist who really has helped me through some very dark times over the last year and a half. I currently am not on any medications, although I've tried many over the years. That I happen to be a person where that course of treatment has not proven valuable. And I would say the number one thing that pulls me through time and again, we come back to my work here, is my writing, the work. When in my worst, darkest times, that's what pulls me through time and again.
Yeah, I've read about some of your darkest times on your blog. Refresh my memory for the sake of our audience. What's the name of your blog?
Sure. You can find my blog at elenamabasso.com, and the tagline there is "Fiction need not apply." So it's very eclectic. But yes, there are a lot of essays there that go to a very personal place with my experiences with depression.
So I want to turn to you, Fred. So we're hearing a lot of things. We heard about this dance troupe. The acting troupe in New York. We hear about the Maxwells. We hear about, you know, Elena said that she writes for herself to help herself get through, but obviously she's not just writing about herself. She's writing for others. What do we know? You're the researcher here, Fred. What do we know about what works, and how do we know it?
Well, we know that on one hand, mass education campaigns, public service announcements, things like that tend not to be as effective as the personal story, the personal experience, knowing somebody who has successfully overcome the challenges associated with a mental illness. Those are the kind of things that I think can be most effective in knowing somebody, whether it be in your workplace or in the community or one of your own family members that has a diagnosis of a mental illness, but yet it doesn't define who they are. Despite having such a diagnosis, they may manage to lead rather productive lives, engaged in meaningful activities, and with, of course, the proper support and treatment, can lead very fulfilling lives and are people not to be necessarily feared or ostracized. And it's those kinds of personal connections that I think are most effective.
So the subtext, I think, of this whole show is about disclosure. So there's not good news, either good news or bad news, about disclosure.
That's right.
Disclosure can get you in a lot of trouble.
That's right. Disclosure is a very tricky issue. On one hand, people have to negotiate in their own lives to whom they should disclose to, under what circumstances, and what's the best way to disclose. And that carries certain risks and benefits associated with it.
Where can we get guidance for that? Well, it's got to be out there for it.
Well, on one hand, I think research has only recently turned to a more sophisticated look at disclosure. Some studies initially suggested that disclosure would lead to greater harm than good. On the other hand, some more recent research suggests that when people learn how to navigate the challenges of disclosure, while it might not lead to immediately a greater acceptance and improvement in their social situation, it can perhaps lead to a sense of personal empowerment, a sense that I can take control of my own situation. And let me add, it may alleviate some of the stress associated with sort of keeping it a secret.
That Lord knows that is terribly stressful. Well, apropos of that, let's go back to the phones, and we've got Tara on the line. Hi, Tara.
Hello, Dan. Your show is just a weekly source of warmth for me. I just love it. Thank you. My theme of my call is truly disclosure. I have a brother who I am immensely proud of and moved by, who's had a 30-year struggle with very severe and disabling obsessive-compulsive disorder. He teaches at an elite private school. He is a beloved teacher in that school. He's received numerous accolades. He's won Teacher of the Year. Just a fabulous teacher who loves what he does. And he has been utterly open about his diagnosis with his teenage students. They all know he takes medication. They know in great detail about his struggles with this. And I think that has contributed to the very warm and honest relationship he has with these teens who see him as a vulnerable person, but still a leader. And he trusts them enough that they can process this, and in return, they share all kinds of things with him. But I'm just kind of amazed at his courage as a teacher, such a public role, being so honest, and the response that it's gotten.
Yeah, I don't know if you heard the whole show, Tara, but we spoke with the Maxwells and
oh, indeed. Yeah, my profound condolences to them.
Their project is about going into colleges, and you're talking about high school kids, and whenever, you know, I talk to kids a lot in various groups, and I talk about vulnerability and what it's like to be so vulnerable and dependent on others. You know, there's a wide variety of themes I talk about, including happiness, but the thing they come up to me most afterwards, after my talk, they want to know more about my depression, and they tell me about theirs. So, you know, we're really doing in my tribe we call it a mitzvah, a good deed, by this self-disclosure. And sometimes we put ourselves at risk. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you,
Elena. Do you feel that you put yourself at risk sometimes?
There absolutely always is that fear, especially to someone like me. I'm a freelance writer and editor. So, you know, it's a kind of a hard scrabble life to begin with. And you always hope that you can, you know, land enough clients and land enough work to keep those bills paid. And I've been fortunate enough to do that for several years now, full time. There always is that fear that when I go public with these issues, that, you know, who knows, maybe there's going to be someone who doesn't want to work with me. If you say you want to know more about me beyond the mental illness, the truth about my life is that I publish between 200 and 300 articles a year in any given year. I work at an extremely high rate, partly because I love to write, and I think also partly because that's my best coping mechanism for the depression, as I was saying. And it is great to hear stories of other successful professionals who are dealing with similar problems and being open about it. And I really love what she says about seeing someone as a vulnerable person and also a leader. We do not have to be invulnerable to be a positive example to other people.
Yep. We recently did a show on that. I don't think we can be an honest leader if we're not vulnerable, if we don't even acknowledge it to ourselves. Mm. You know. So you publish 200 articles a year. So this begs the question in my mind, where my little neurotic mind goes, is I wonder if, given my NPR salary, I could afford to hire this woman as my writing teacher. But boy, do you have a lot to teach me. We've only got another minute left. So, Fred, tell us where we're going. We're going to, if we have this show again in 5-10 years, where are we going to be?
Well, on one hand, as a social scientist, my job is to be somewhat skeptical, and so I am cautiously optimistic, I would say. The stigma of mental illness is deeply entrenched, and it has not changed all that much over the last several decades. But on the other hand, I do have some faith in young people, because they have a much a more open mind to a wide variety of social issues, for example, in terms of sexuality and race relationships. And so I think they may be a little more open-minded when it comes to talking about mental illness, bringing it out of the closet, recognizing that when people have it, they should not be ashamed of getting the help they need, and perhaps getting the social support of their friends and their family to help keep their lives on track.
Thank you for that. And Elena, we've only got a couple seconds left.
I would just say that I really appreciate the chance to continue the conversation in this forum.
And I appreciate the work both of you do. It's been such an important show. My guests today have been Dr. Fred Markowitz. He's an associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Northern Illinois. Elena Mabasso has also been with us for the entire show. She's a writer and a blogger. We also heard earlier from Lori and Lee Maxwell, who were starting DMAX, a foundation in memory of their son, Dan. And I'll be interviewing, by the way, Patrick Kennedy on April 27th at Bryn Mawr College. Well, you can follow us at voices@whyy.org. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is the executive producer. Zakiya Gibbons is our intern. Larry Roebling produces this show. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Have a good week.